Darraby didn't get much space in the guidebooks. But when it was mentioned, it was described as a grey little town on the River Darrow, with a cobbled marketplace and little of interest except its two ancient bridges. But when you looked at it, its setting was beautiful. On the pebbly river, where the houses clustered thickly and straggled unevenly along the lower slopes of Herne Fell. Everywhere in Darraby, in the streets, through the windows of the houses, you could see the fell rearing its calm green bulk more than 2,000 feet above the huddled roofs. There was a clarity in the air, a sense of space and airiness, that made me feel I had shed something on the plain 20 miles behind. The confinement of the city, the grime, the smoke, already they seemed to be falling away from me. Trengate was a quiet street leading off the square, and I had my first sight of Skeldale House. I knew it was the right place before I was near enough to read S. Farnan MRCBS on the old-fashioned brass plate, hanging slightly askew on the iron railings. I knew by the ivy which climbed untidily over the mellow brick to the topmost windows. It was what the letter had said, the only house with ivy, and this could be where I would work for the first time as a veterinary surgeon. Now that I was here, right on the doorstep, I felt breathless, as though I'd been running. If I got the job, this was where I would find out about myself. There were many things to prove. But I liked the look of the old house. It was Georgian, with a fine, white-painted doorway. The windows, too, were white, wide and graceful on the ground floor and the first story, but small and square where they peeped out from under the overhanging tiles far above. The paint was flaking and the mortar looked crumbly between the bricks, but there was a changeless elegance about the place. There was no front garden, and only the railings separated the house from the street a few feet away. I rang the doorbell, and instantly the afternoon peace was shattered by a distant baying like a wolf pack in full cry. The upper half of the door was of glass, and as I peered through, a river of dogs poured round the corner of a long passage and dashed itself with frenzied yells against the door. If I hadn't been used to animals, I would have turned and run for my life. As it was, I stepped back warily and watched the dogs as they appeared, sometimes two at a time, at the top of their leap, eyes glaring, jaws slavering. After a minute or two of this, I was able to sort them out, and I realized that my first rough count of about 14 was exaggerated. There were, in fact, 5. A huge fawn greyhound, who appeared most often as he hadn't so far to jump as the others, a cocker spaniel, a scotty, a whippet, and a tiny short-legged hunt terrier. This terrier was seldom seen since the glass was rather high for him. But when he did make it, he managed to get an even more frantic note into his bark before he disappeared. I was thinking of ringing the bell again when I saw a large woman in the passage. She rapped out a single word, and the noise stopped as if by magic. When she opened the door, the ravening pack was slinking round her feet ingratiatingly, showing the whites of their eyes and wagging their tucked-in tails. I had never seen such a servile crew. "Good afternoon," I said with my best smile. "My name is Harriet." The woman looked bigger than ever with the door open. She was about 60, but her hair, tightly pulled back from her forehead, was jet black and hardly streaked with grey. She nodded and looked at me with grim benevolence, but she seemed to be waiting for further information. Evidently, the name struck no answering spark. "Mr. Farnan is expecting me. He wrote asking me to come today."
"Mr. Harriet," she said thoughtfully, "surgery is from 6 to 7 o'clock. If you wanted to bring a dog in, that would be your best time." "No, no," I said, hanging on to my smile. "I'm applying for the position of assistant. Mr. Farnan said to come in time for tea."
"Assistant? Well, now, that's nice."
The lines in her face softened a little.
"I'm Mrs. Hall. I keep house for Mr. Farnan. He's a bachelor, you know. He never said anything to me about you, but never mind. Come in and have a cup of tea." "He shouldn't be long before he's back."
I followed her between the whitewashed walls, my feet clattering on the tiles. We turned right at the end into another passage, and I was beginning to wonder just how far back the house extended when I was shown into a sunlit room. It had been built in the grand manner, high-ceilinged and airy, with a massive fireplace flanked by arched alcoves. One end was taken up by a French window which gave on a long high-walled garden. I could see unkempt lawns, a rockery, and many fruit trees. A great bank of peonies blazed in the hot sunshine, and at the far end, rooks cawed in the branches of a group of tall elms. Above and beyond were the green hills with their climbing walls. Ordinary-looking furniture stood around on a very worn carpet. Hunting prints hung on the walls, and books were scattered everywhere, some on shelves in the alcoves, but others piled on the floor in the corners. A pewter pint pot occupied a prominent place at one end of the mantelpiece. It was an interesting pot. Checks and banknotes had been stuffed into it till they bulged out of the top and overflowed onto the hearth beneath. I was studying this with astonishment when Mrs. Hall came in with a tea tray. "I suppose Mr. Farnan's out on a case," I said. "No, he's gone through to Broughton to visit his mother. I can't really say when he'll be back." She left me with my tea.